Well, it's a Friday morning, and we are in the 7 o'clock hour, heading towards 8 o'clock. It is time for the Media Beat with David Terachuk. David, of course, joins us every week. He has his own website, themediabeat.us, and he's also a PBS television correspondent on ethics and Melissa. And we're always great to have him in the studio talking with us about the media. And quite a lot going on, crossing the wires and on radio and TV and the media over the past couple of days, David.
I should say so. I'm glad to be reporting in again, once again, from the media capital of the world, New York City, joining forces with the inquiring mind and the astute observation of Marshall Miles. And yes, it has been a busy media week. I guess it forces us to consider the role of journalism in conflict, actual military combat, and even solely the threat of combat. A lot of it to be reported on this week. The challenge that faces reporters is to be not just a mouthpiece, while of course fully reporting what national leaders are saying and doing. The problem, of course, is that reporters and analytical observers too are always at risk, at least, of being enrolled by the actual or potential combatants in a supporting role. I mean, it's propaganda is what it's about, of course. Propaganda is a vital part of all wars and all warlike contentiousness. And as the old saying goes, in war, truth is the first casualty. Well, the responsibility of the media in whichever country they are based in or wherever they serve is all the greater when military action breaks out, and just as much so, of course, when it's being threatened as it has been in the Ukraine, for instance. But there was a classic instance yesterday when we saw claims of military success being made from the Biden White House, and then President Biden himself, not a normal action for him, presenting himself as a martial champion. The announcement was, of course, that U.S. Special Forces had, quote, taken off the battlefield. That's a very careful phrase there. The ISIS leader, Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qureshi in northwest Syria. There's to be, of course, as there always is, an after-action review, as it's called by the military, about that raid. But that hasn't stopped, even while it's pending, that hasn't stopped multiple sources in the administration briefing reporters to explain the at least 13 additional casualties that were reported on the ground. Those included women and children, and that information is based on accounts from the generally reliable civilian rescue workers, the famous Syrian white helmets, and from other civilian sources too. The explanation being offered in Washington is that al-Qureshi set off an explosive device himself when he came under attack. And that's a similar story, a very similar story to what we heard when his predecessor as leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, was killed in a previous special ops raid in 2019. So, you know, that other well-used aphorism about this whole subject, journalism is the first draft of history. Remember that phrase? I think we can look forward in this case to, I think, various changes, challenges, developments at the least, to this first draft of the story.
It's the time we live in because social media now drives things and drives journalists, some journalists, not all journalists, and some journalistic organizations to move quickly on stories. And you know, we talk about the Ukraine, we talk about ISIS. I want to get to Ukraine because it's interesting. The U.S. is now alleging that Russia is planning a false flag operation against Ukraine. This is almost like the movie Wag the Dog.
They're getting media plot to engineer a war. I mean that's what the United States is now accusing the Russians of doing, inventing some video that would provide evidence, you know, evidence in quotation marks of of the Ukrainians doing something dastardly against Russians, and possibly in the east of Ukraine, or Russian supporters, Russian speakers, there are many of them, or it could be any other kind of alleged abuse that the Russians could be manufacturing the Ukrainians as having done. And this would provide the ideal pretext for an invasion. Now, how credible that is up for grabs, I think. But you know, I don't think we should put anything past Vladimir Putin and his KGB trained circle of military advisors. Many of them have had the same experience as him, and ever since he was a KGB man in what was then Leningrad, and then also in East Germany, the propaganda side, as I was just saying, of all wars, is something that they are particularly expert at. Not that we don't have our own experts, we certainly do. But what's going on, of course, is that there's a lot of signaling. We talked about it last week, and I think the week before, semaphoring and signaling from both of the big powers involved here, the United States and Russia. It's how you read those signals and how the signals are conveyed that's really a matter for really responsible reporting and analysis by the media. But one of the things about Ukraine we just should not lose sight of is that the voice least heard, or I'd say perhaps least fully heeded, are the Ukrainians themselves, drowned out, it seems, by the big powers who are beating their chests around them. If you seek out actual Ukrainian sources, as my colleague at the Media Beat, Jess Burke, has been doing this week, you get some heartfelt analysis like that of Mykhailo Winitsky, who's a political and strategic expert at the National University there, the Kiev Mohyla Academy, which, by the way, dates back to the 17th century. The message there in this very interesting piece that he wrote was, Ukraine has been reduced to the status of a bystander in its own national drama. And while he gives, as he should, I guess, gives voice, like many Ukrainians, to the gratitude that they feel for support coming from the West, they do feel that the defense of Ukraine is a matter for Ukrainians themselves to take the lead in. And what they do stress, unlike many international observers, this is a long-term matter. Let me quote him directly. He says, regardless of the short-term tactical diplomatic victories or losses, and of course we now are seeing lots of diplomacy going on in many different directions, he says the strategic focus remains the same in spite of those diplomatic stratagems going on. Russia presents, he says, an existential threat to Ukraine that is not going to disappear anytime soon. As long as Ukraine exists as a democratic state that is not directly controlled by Moscow, the country will be constantly under threat. The headline on this analysis of his, by the way, is, or rather intentionally, is stop asking what Putin wants and start asking what Ukraine wants. At the same time, Ukrainians in general have been, I mean, those in authority have been careful to say that the other part of the long-standing nature of this threat from Russia also means that panic now about Russia's actual intentions is unwise too. It's a hard balance to strike between, you know, having a well-prepared defense and some kind of national alarm, but they want to strike that, and they need to strike that balance, and we can understand why that should be the case.
Right, it's an unbelievable situation with so many different hotspots all over the world, and then we can go back and the media once again is starting to cover what happened many, many years ago, first in Cuba. And that is when our agents in our embassy had dizzy spells, loss of memory. And now it has been confirmed, direct energy. Why has this story taken so long to come to the forefront when so many of our citizens in these foreign countries have felt this effect for years?
Well, the effect's been varied in different places, and it's hard to figure out who could be organizing something as well spread out, so as widely occurring in so many different capitals. And all the time, the technical investigation has been a very slow. I mean, and perhaps understandably so. It's not an easy thing to do, but it seems now that we're getting some gritty information, and the microwave energy that's employed in this seems to indicate that it is indeed it has been an attack. Although, you know, for a long time, it was such an incredible notion that people reporting the ill effects were told to, you know, perhaps they were exaggerating it, and maybe they should you know, take it easy, and they were maybe imagining it. Was some of the messaging that you had addressed to you if you were an embassy staffer and you were feeling these ill effects? And it wasn't taken seriously to begin with, and that's one of the reasons that it's taken so long to get investigated fully and thoroughly.
We move on to Boris Johnson, and he's really, I don't know if he's in trouble or not, because I'm not that.
But let's say he's in trouble.
Senior aides now have asked him to resign.
Well, yeah. Boris Johnson is one of the many Europeans at the moment rushing to the aid of the Ukraine in very ostentatious ways, some with good intent and deliberate diplomacy to offer. Boris Johnson has taken a step in that direction too, so, and some of it's very practical. Britain is sending a particular form of short-range anti-tank missile to help Ukraine. But all Boris Johnson's loyalists, who are, you're absolutely right, are shrinking in number. They make great play of this Ukraine action as something that the media should be taking notice of, instead of all this domestic trouble that Johnson's got so thoroughly gotten himself into in a way that only Boris Johnson probably could. It's all about him and his staff not obeying the COVID rules while imposing those rules on the rest of Britain's ordinary folk, of course. And now he's lost his main policy aide and also his main communications advisor, and even his Chancellor of the Exchequer, the essentially the Secretary of the Treasury for Britain, is taking steps to distance himself from Boris now, in this particular case, because of Boris's way of handling his political troubles. It's to lash out in very Boris type fashion against the leader of the opposition in a way that is absolutely below the belt. All British politicians would probably agree. He was accusing him, Keir Starmer is the man's name, the leader of the opposition, the leader of the Labour Party, who in his history has been a public prosecutor, and quite without any evidence at all, and entirely wrongly and insupportably, Boris Johnson accusing him of not prosecuting an infamous broadcasting pedophile in British broadcasting history, a name that nobody in this country probably knows, Jimmy Savile. But it was an infamous story in Britain, and to blame the leader of the opposition for not prosecuting that criminal promptly enough is a piece of history that even Boris Johnson is stretching a bit to try and rewrite in that direction. And sure enough, as a consequence, even some of his top-level supporters are now deserting him. So the conversation that we have every week about how much trouble is Boris Johnson in takes another twist this week. And the answer is, well, he's in more trouble. But whether he can pull himself out of it is one of those extraordinary questions about Boris Johnson that you can never actually answer until it's actually happened. So I'm making no predictions about Boris Johnson's survival. survival or his failure. I'm going to just sit back and wait for it to happen.
You know, something that we talked about when Brexit first came up, and now it's raised its head, and that is that the Northern Ireland Protocol has given way now to Paul in announcing his resignation as First Minister of Northern Ireland effective midnight.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that was inevitable in given all the political flow here. We are getting to the point where Northern Ireland is in a state of tension again about the same old issues that have been now brought to the fore again by, guess who, Boris Johnson, in essence, the decision of Britain under Boris Johnson to leave the European Union has raised, in effect, the prospect of a hard border across the island of Ireland, the very thing that kept the whole place in a state of war for three decades at least this last century. And the fact that Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, in the south of the island, is in Europe still, makes for a disjointedness, which brings attention back to that border drawn 100 years ago across the island, purely to protect the interests of the majority of Northern Ireland, which of course that majority wants to stay and identifies very closely with the UK. Now they are not in Europe, but the rest of the island of Ireland is in Europe. So the tensions brought by that have brought about the political crisis that we're potentially facing now. That again is something we've been talking about a lot recently, and as you know, I've been reporting from Ireland about it. It's going to focus the minds of political leaders in Northern Ireland yet again. And one of the terrible things is you're seeing a stiffening of positions, particularly on the unionist side, those who do want to keep the connection with Britain. And there are suspicions, there are certainly been threats of violence from that side. And even to the point of, I learned about this only recently, customs workers being threatened to the point of needing to be rehoused because they are abiding by the rules of the new situation in which goods coming from the mainland UK to Northern Ireland have to be checked, and just doing their job, they're now being threatened at gunpoint and taken away to safer housing, they and their families. That's a terrible situation, and it's a terrible harking back to the bad old days.
And we'll come back to the United States, and I'm surprised more media, I haven't seen much media get on top of the story. But in the Republican Party, there is a storm brewing, and it's a three front storm. You have Donald Trump, who has raised once again a massive amount of money for his run for president. But you also now have Donald Trump going up against McConnell and also DeSantis. You have three strong leaders that are now in a triangle, two of them opposing Donald Trump on a lot of different things. This could really spell problems for the Republicans in the 2020 in the midterm, simply because Donald Trump's voters are going to stay with Donald Trump, and it could really put a big split in the party.
Well, sure, and the Republican Party is, reporting that party's fortunes at the moment is all a matter of of figuring out the balance between those people who are frightened of Trump and those people who overtly and strongly support him. The fight for the soul of the Republican Party, if the Republican Party can be said to have a soul, is going to be played out between now and the midterms. And of course, looking forward to 2024 as a presidential election in which he is threatening to run again. Yes, you've got an interesting prospect. It's common enough in countries around the world that when the one of the main parties is in opposition, that is when they start their infighting within themselves. And it's all about, you know, inevitably, who will lead the onslaught against the occupant in our case in the White House, and of course in the two houses of Congress. Their preparedness for that fight seems to be determined by this single issue: how much of a Trumpian are you? And how much do you need to be, and how frightened of Trump and his supporters taking you out at the primary stage, for instance, do you have to be concerned about that?
And then you could also add in other Republicans that are feeling the wrath of Donald Trump. It's going to be a very interesting lead up to the midterm elections, not only on the Democratic side, because we have Democrats now coming out against the vice president, and we have Republicans coming out against the former president. So it should make an interesting media.
Well, what can we say? It's a midterm year. We'll get a lot of this between now and November on both sides of the aisle.
Well, David, it's always great to chat with you on a Friday morning, and I hope the weather in New York is better than it is up here.
I think it will be, but my sympathies are with you.
All right, David, we'll speak to you next week.
Bye now.
Take care. That is David Taraschuk with the Media Beat. David, of course, joins us on a Friday morning here on Robinhood Radio. And if you want to listen to the Media Beat, well, you can. Robinhoodradio.com, click on demand, click on the Media Beat with David Taraschuk.